industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
I'm happy to reintroduce Dr. Noah Berlin, who's the Assistant Director of the Division of Medical Toxicology at Kings County Hospital and SUNY Downstate Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, where he works now as an emergency physician. Dr. Berlin completed his MedTox Fellowship at Rutgers NJMS in Newark, New Jersey, and his residency in emergency medicine at Kings County Hospital, SUNY Downstate in Brooklyn. He's also been an avid home brewer of beer for the past 15 years, lives in Brooklyn, and which apparently is formerly the beer capital of the world, according to Noah, and I'm sure some other people. And he's a huge fan of the local breweries. So thank you for joining, Noah, and I give the mic to you.
Thank you so much, Adam. My talk today is titled A Stable Head with a Broken Heart. I wish I had some disclosures to disclose, starting with prehistory. And before the main topic of our discussion, just want to talk a little bit about fermentation. This is the oldest way to preserve foods, to when you farm something, when you are able to gather things and then keep it for the next harvest over time periods when you're not able to grow that item. Lactofermentation, or in this case, we're going to talk a little bit more about yeast and alcohol fermentation. Bread and beer are kind of really the exact same process from the most basic level of some carbohydrate source and yeast and water. Those three things combined, and then it's just the way that you treat it. And for the case of bread, it's a much shorter fermentation period where you're trying to just generate CO2 to make something nice and fluffy. Sourdough, you do get some acetic acid, esters, and other kind of maybe even a little bit of alcohol. And then you get your nice fluffy crumb. With the case of beer or other alcohols, you're trying to generate alcohol for its intoxicating effects. As somebody named Noah, I definitely can't pass up mentioning my biblical namesake. This is a painting by Giovanni Bellini depicting the drunkenness of Noah. Noah in the Old Testament is actually the person depicted as kind of discovering wine, and this depicts him becoming intoxicated and being found by his sons naked and then covering him up. So just an interesting historical point, or a semi-historical point. Now, though today, we don't think about this region as being that fertile. At the time, it's actually kind of the breadbasket of the world and where domestication of grains and wheat began. So this is the Fertile Crescent. And now it's more kind of desert, but with various climate changes and shifts in rivers and snowfall, we used to have the Tigris, the Euphrates, and the Nile rivers, which just made this area so verdant and where we then, as I said, domesticated grains, especially wheat initially. From there, we kind of spread grain throughout the world, and this specifically depicts the spread of grain throughout Europe. We think now, I think most people think of European styles of beers as kind of the inventors and the perfectors of beer styles, but in reality, beer first probably came from that Fertile Crescent region. It's not surprising to think that where you have grain and you're making bread, you know, just a little bit of different time, you get beer and you're going to, you know, enjoy that maybe even more so, or certainly with some beer, some bread. For this story, we do need to talk a little bit about the anatomy of a beer. And I don't think this is going to be a surprise to anyone, but the two main most important components are probably the body and the head. I think nowadays most people are aiming to pour their beers and tilt the glass over and reduce that head. But really, it's a huge part of our entire experience of enjoying a beer. The body is certainly where the majority of the flavor and where all the alcohol is contained. But the head creates this visual experience and adds to the aroma. And so when you're a beer brewer, you're trying to figure out how to have a stable head that will stay there for a while. And this can be from a variety of salts, dissolved solids, proteins that help you kind of attain this. Now, water is the main ingredient in beer or any distilled spirit or wine. And with that comes not terroir, because that means the land, but so much of the specific style and quality of a beer. And this really is where we're bringing a lot of those unique minerals, electrolytes, and other dissolved solids that make one beer different from another regionally, or even, you know, a different sake or wine different. Now, this is what defines New York pizza and bagels compared to getting, you know, the exact same thing in Florida or California or even, you know, the likes of New Jersey. So the next most important part is our grain. Just wanted to depict kind of how we develop a style. And it's generally a blend of different colors and roast levels of our grain. And this is kind of developed through the Maillard reaction. Most notably, these are probably malted barleys. Malted barley is when you let a bit of barley germinate, and that allows it to develop certain enzymes that are able to convert our complex carbohydrates into simple carbohydrates. In the case of, say, Japanese sakes, you use koji to perform the same basic task, which is a fungus. When you have a darker roast, you get more of those Maillard flavors, like coffee, chocolate flavors. And by mixing that with different levels and different roasts, you might create a different style. You then add yeast combined with the water and whatever grain you're using, which would be your mash. The yeast then, as I said before, is used to convert those complex or really simple carbohydrates into your alcohol. Also generates other specific notes. We grow kind of or cultivate specific yeast breeds to create different flavor profiles and different levels of alcohol content. In most European styles, they follow the Germans, and you're also going to add some hops or other flavorings. And then you get beer, which I think takes us to 1965, Quebec City, Canada. So it all started in a pretty hot August summer when four individuals were admitted to multiple hospitals throughout Quebec City. This maybe didn't seem too weird initially because they didn't show up at the same place at the same time, but they had the same basic presentation. They had rapid onset heart failure, they had polycythemia, and they had pericardial effusions. This initially went pretty unnoticed because these are the people that sadly, you know, society mostly ignores. These cases continued over the next few months. There was just one admission in September, so again, easy to miss. But then there were eight more in October, and this just continued over the next 9 months with never more than nine at a time. But it kind of took three important individuals who easily could have missed this, but started to see these patients much more frequently. So we have Dr. Yves Morin, Dr. André Tatou, and Dr. Gaston Mercier, who together kind of started noting this and came together and discussed this new unique presentation. Now, why weren't this just the classics? We know that alcohol itself is cardiotoxic, and in chronic use, you get, you know, dilated cardiomyopathy. You can also get wet and dry beriberi, you know, thiamine deficiency. For one, these are usually a little bit more insidious and not so acute onset. The total picture also just didn't fit. They didn't have any of the hallmark signs of either of these diseases. So it seemed like it was something else. So they formed a team. It was actually quite large and involved the national government, the law enforcement. It included the provincial department of health. They involved Montreal, which is nearby in a much larger city, and started to figure out what happened or what was going on. So what was causing this? In the early 1900s Manchester, there was actually a case of beer drinkers being poisoned with arsenic. And so that was one of the things they very early on considered. However, this just really did not fit the clinical picture. Then they said, well, could this be an infectious cause going through our, you know, heavy drinking population? Could it be a virus? Could it be a bacteria? But pretty quickly that was eliminated. They started to explore other possible exposures, metals. Maybe this was some illicit substance that people were using as well. Kind of one by one, all of these things were eliminated. But the hint came from an autopsy. One of the patients who had passed was getting an ME exam, and their thyroid tissue looked just like these pathology slides. Now, these pathology slides are from a sister who, her and her twin, were being treated with a medication for anemia. And this then made them realize that it seemed to be connected with this similar presentation of these young children getting bronchovite. Now, bronchovite was kind of seen in the 1920s when researchers found that cobalt caused polycythemia. And so they said, wow, this is genius. We should combine it with iron. And this seemed really great. Children's, you know, anemia recovered, but then they developed these large goiters and developed hypothyroidism because cobalt seemed to be interfering with iodine uptake. So this seemed to give them their smoking gun. But the question was, where was cobalt coming from? Well, it kind of turned out that Quebec City, this is before globalization, only had one brewery, which was Dow Brewery. And in further investigation and discussions with Dow, they realized that they had literally just started adding cobalt to their beer in June of 1965 as a stabilizer of the head. Again, that's we're all trying to get a stable head just really for that appearance. But the question was, why was this happening only in Quebec City? Because in discussions with Dow, it turned out that they were also putting it into their beer in Montreal. The difference was that in Montreal, they were only adding it to the draft beer. They weren't adding it to any of the bottled beer. And it was nearly 20 times higher in concentration of cobalt in Quebec City's beer. So there seemed to be both a dose and the packaging difference between the two cities. Public health authorities required Dow to dump all of their beer, and they made them put it into the river. So maybe the fish were happy. Pretty quickly, though, Dow started to challenge this in public and placing multiple ads in the newspaper, which you can still search and find today, questioning whether or not this was required. So, one of the ways that you can show causality is looking at when cases started and when they ended. Did the cases start and go away, kind of correlating with the cobalt addition? The top of this chart is to show Quebec City, but the bottom you'll see that it says Omaha. It wasn't until it was discovered in Quebec that they started to realize this was happening in many other places, including Omaha, Nebraska, Minneapolis, and in Belgium, beer brewery workers. But as you can see, cobalt started being added in June. 2 months later is when we first started to see our four patients appear. And then they removed it from the market in the middle of March, and all cases disappeared by May. So there seems to be a pretty clear causality. Now, just to look through a little bit of the patient population, who was getting sick? Well, pretty normal distribution around middle-aged drinkers. This probably follows the age a little bit, at least of heavy drinkers at the time. So it looked like middle-aged people, the most populous of those were the ones who were having the largest number of cases. But if you look at death and how much they drank, well, first, these people were drinking large amounts. So over here, it's 200 plus ounces a day, and that seemed to increase the incidence of cases. In terms of years, the longer you've been drinking also seemed to correlate pretty well with cases. And then looking at death, though, it really was the number of years that somebody had been drinking that really seemed to correlate the strongest. The people who had been drinking for the longest period of time, who probably were already the most nutritionally deficient and illest from their substance use disorder, are the ones who were dying most frequently. And you can see there were really very few deaths in the younger group of patients who were getting sick. Overall, 20 out of 48 patients passed away. Now, did they recover? Based on follow-up data, about 20 out of 34 patients in Omaha, Nebraska actually gained full cardiac function back. And this is actually chest X-ray from initial presentation to a follow-up chest X-ray 4 months after discharge. Pretty drastic changes. In Omaha, two patients who did seem to have a full recovery and were able to be discharged did pass away, sadly. So, how is cobalt toxic anyway? Well, maybe it wouldn't be a good tox lecture without bringing up the citric acid cycle. More specifically, it's actually alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. And even more specifically, it is the E2 subunit, which is actually deactivated through the thiol groups, where cobalt kind of coordinates with the two thiol groups on lipoamide lipoic acid. And this prevents the conversion of NAD plus to NADH. Now, it's a pretty weak inhibitor of the E2 complex. And we didn't see this in young children happening. We didn't see the heart failure. There's obviously large differences between these two populations, but the biggest difference is the alcohol consumption. And alcohol, as we all know, shifts our NAD plus to NADH ratio towards NADH. And it looks like this is very synergistic with alcohol consumption and that NADH to NAD plus ratio. And in some rat studies that were performed, it showed that you pretty much had no heart failure in any patients who were not getting alcohol. And when adding alcohol to their water sources, they were getting this exact same clinical presentation. Now, you might ask me, Has this ever happened again? Like, should this be something we're concerned about, or is this just something for the past? Well, maybe many of you recognize this episode of House. We have Murphy Brown or Candace Bergman playing Dr. Cuddy's mother, suffering from some mysterious illness. This case, this episode, was actually useful and used by some doctors in Germany to diagnose cobalt intoxication. And the source in that case was a metal-on-metal hip. Nowadays, almost every single call you're going to get at poison control or as a consultant or in the hospital is going to be related to a metal-on-metal hip. At this point, there's various guidelines directing how to manage these levels, but anybody with a metal-on-metal hip pretty much is going to be getting some degree of monitoring for their cobalt, chromium levels, and a few other metals as well. In summary, heavy daily beer drinkers in Quebec City in 1965 developed sudden onset heart failure. These cases almost went completely missed, if not for those three amazing physicians, and it was thyroid tissue that ultimately led them down the line of noting that it was cobalt intoxication. Dow Brewery was identified as the most likely source, and once they removed it from their beer as a beer head stabilizer, all cases stopped. These cases continued throughout the world, and over time has been eliminated from all brewing practices. Most patients do end up surviving, but it seems to affect the oldest patients the most, and that they certainly have the highest mortality. And it's the cobalt with synergism with ethanol and nutritional deficiency that seems to directly interfere with the E2 subunit of alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase. Now, you're mostly going to worry about this in the setting of prosthetic hips, specifically metal on metal. These are my references, and thank you all so much if you have any questions.